Welcome, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Roller Out the Barrel, the Vintage Baseball Podcast that usually talks to vintage baseball players from coast to coast and border to border, but we have a special guest today. You all know her, but you don't know a lot about her. We're going to try to change a little of that today. On the phone line, we are blessed to have Marjorie Adams. Marjorie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Matthew. How are you?
Great. I'm dealing with about 5 days of rain.
We need rain up here in New England. We're parched. So you're very lucky. Send some our way.
We are right now. So, so this rain is coming to you. And, you know, Marjorie, this is the first time I think that we've talked. We've been social media friends for a couple of years.
Yep.
So
this is fun.
Before we get into a bunch of my questions and everything, tell everybody your relation to Doc Adams.
Doc is my great-grandfather, which sounds very weird that here in 2020, I am only two generations away from someone who died in 1899. My Doc got married when he was 47, and my grandfather was born when Doc was 60 in 1874. And my grandfather was in his late 30s when my father was born in 1908, and my father was 40 when I was born. So all these men had the next generation kind of late. And so that's why Doc is only my great-grandfather.
Well, I noticed that he lived, I believe he was 83, 84 when he passed away?
1899.
So how old was he?
He was about 84, 85.
And that's
he was born in 1814.
That's a pretty good life expectancy there. That's probably definitely above the normal. And so maybe the key to life is not getting married until you're in your mid to late 40s.
Could be. I should have tried that. Maybe I'd feel a whole lot younger today if I had subscribed to that.
So I'm gonna give you the basic question here in a second about who was Doc Adams to baseball and all that stuff. I know you have to give this speech to everybody and you have it memorized. You don't even have the notes in your pocket anymore. You have this part memorized. But I want to start it with, you're going to tell me why Doc Adams should be in the Hall of Fame. But the first question I want to ask you is, why is Doc Adams not in the Hall of Fame?
I think he's not in the Hall of Fame yet because people didn't really know about him. This is not a family into self-promotion. This is not a family that would boast or brag. That's not our way. And I think it's really a matter of education. So I'm not trying so much to get Doc in the hall, although that, of course, is the desired result. I really want to educate people about Doc so that they say, wow, he should be in the Hall of Fame. And about 6 years ago, I was talking to a local sports writer about Doc. And he looked at me and he said, I guess you can't tell the history of baseball without Doc Adams. And, well, that line struck me because it's obvious. It's true. So I'm really here to educate people about Doc so they realize how obvious it is that he should be in the hall.
When he retired from baseball officially in 1862, I think he left the board of the Knickerbockers. Am I correct on that?
Yes. He left it all behind. And it took me a while to figure out why, because he was only 47 or 48 by then. But he had gotten married the year before for the first time. He was 47, and his wife was 33. And I figured out through family letters written right around the time that Doc retired from the Knickerbockers that she was pregnant with their first child. And I think Doc's motive was, it's time for me to be a husband and a father and nothing else. And so he retired in March of 1862. Sadly, she would lose that baby in May and was terribly ill. It almost killed her. And she really did not recover till September. The other thing that helped me figure this out, in 1888, Doc was asked, along with his other classmates, to write a little autobiography for a Yale alumni publication. It's not very long. It should be on our website. And in it, he never mentions baseball. But he does say, and I'm going to quote, "My marriage was the crowning achievement of my life," unquote. So I think that's a real clue into Doc, that his marriage was more important to him than baseball.
Because
he never wrote about it. We have nothing in the family written by Doc about what he felt about baseball or his participation in it. Nothing.
Oh.
My grandfather wrote an essay in 1939, which we have, with his memories of what his father told him. But Doc never wrote anything down. So that gives you a lot of clues into the man that he was.
Right. So he loved baseball, but it wasn't a main priority. So in 62, when he retires, he does play the occasional baseball game after that, but having anything to do with baseball as far as administration or anything, that's all done. And that, I would say, that probably hurt him in the fact that when he retired, baseball was still in its infancy. And, if he would have stayed on in some role, I think more people would know what he did in the beginning of baseball.
Absolutely. I agree completely.
So go ahead and from the beginning of Doc Adams, and I'm going to interject here on some points when you come on to them, but tell us, in your abridged version, you don't have to go into great detail, but if you want great detail about Doc Adams, by the way, you can go to docadamsbaseball.org. Tell us who Doc Adams was to baseball.
Who was he to baseball? Well, his three primary achievements. Number one, in the early days of his club, there was not a lot of enthusiasm for the game, and it was difficult to get players to show up. And Doc, as president of the club, it was left up to him to get people to show up to play. Now I'm talking 1846 to about 1851, 52. And so it was up to Doc to get people to show up. So number one, he hammered people. Show up, show up, show up. And if he hadn't done that, nobody would have shown up to play the game. Number two, he made all the balls for the club because there was nobody making them in a commercial venture. And he supervised the manufacture of the bats. So no bats, no balls, no baseball. So I think in the early years, those were his most important contributions. The next one, of course, is that he created the shortstop position in 1849-1850. And that position was necessary because the balls that Doc made were so light. You could bat them quite a distance, you just couldn't throw them very far. So the shortstop position was created as a relay to bring batted balls in from the outfield into the infield.
So
that, of course, was pivotal to the game.
So in turn, when he invented the shortstop position, he is also the creator of the cutoff throw.
Okay. I am not an expert on baseball, believe me.
So
isn't that funny?
What you're
so I'm not going to argue with you, Matthew.
It just
goes to reason that he created this position, which is arguably the most important position on a defense right now in Major League Baseball.
Yes.
That he created this position to be the go-between between the outfielders and where the ball had to go to, because yep. the ball wouldn't travel that far. And that is a cutoff throw. He invented the cutoff throw.
Okay. I've never heard it referred to that, so now I've learned something.
And because even in today's baseball, throwing it from the outfield to home, or you don't know where everybody's running to and everything, you got to throw it to the shortstop or the second baseman, depending on what side of the field it's on.
Absolutely.
To see where everything is going on. So he actually created more than just the shortstop position. He created a strategy, actually, a defensive strategy when he did that. So I find that fascinating. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to bring that up.
No.
When the shortstop stuff came up. Please continue.
Okay. I think his last two contributions were in 1857. He was an advocate for nine men, nine innings. I don't think it was an original thought, because lots of clubs were doing it, but it had not yet been codified. And Doc was a proponent of nine men, nine innings, whereas other members of his club wanted seven men and seven innings. And Doc was also the one who did the calculation to set the bases at 90 feet. As anyone who's played vintage ball who's listening today, they will know that up until 1857, the distance between bases was 42 paces, which, of course, was imprecise because your pace is different from mine and so forth.
Sure.
And I think that calculates out to about 75 feet. But Doc set them at 90. And there's a baseball writer in the 1950s, Red Allen, who said the closest man has ever come to perfection is 90 feet between bases, which I think is a great quote. And I know that in Ken Burns' documentary on baseball, I don't know who the writer is. There's another writer who's shown on screen. And I remember he said that whoever set the bases at 90 feet was a genius. 89 would have been too short. 91 would have been too far. So I found that very interesting. Additionally, he was a strong proponent for the fly game as opposed to the bound game. And, of course, all your audience will know what the difference is. And Doc advocated for it as early as 1856, maybe earlier. And he was head of the Rules Committee of the National Association of Baseball Players from 1858 through 1861, and was a proponent for it and proposed it every single year. It didn't pass until after he had retired from the game. It passed, as I'm sure all your listeners know, it passed in 1864. The first playing season was 1865.
Does he get...
When there was no more bound game, just the fly game.
Marjorie, when that passes in 1864, does he get the credit for that?
I don't have any idea. And you know, I don't think he would have cared. But in his 1894 interview with Sporting News, he does mention it, that he advocated for it at every single meeting of the association. And in his last speech before the association, he said, it will happen someday. He predicted that it would pass someday. So I think, and it's not so much Doc, I also think it was the growth of the game. One of the reasons there seems to have been so much reluctance to the fly game in the early years was that a lot of the players were very new to the game. And as all your vintage ball players will tell you, catching a ball without a glove is no fun if you don't know how to do it. Right. And I remember a vintage ball player said to me that you sort of have to catch the ball as if you're catching an egg. Fascinating. I mean, I don't know how they do it. And think of all these things while they're running and catching, but I really don't. But I lost my train of thought for a second.
You know, when we practice, we do practice catching the ball like an egg. When you're in a game, you do not think about how to catch the ball properly. You just you just want to catch it.
You just want to catch the darn thing.
Or at least knock it down.
And that's fair. That's perfectly fair. But I think Doc also felt that it made the game more manly. I mean, games of bat and ball in going back in the midst of time was more a child's game. But I think there were all these efforts to make the sport more manly. And I think they deliberately wanted to make it a little harder, a little bit more of a challenge. And I think that was part of it as well.
Well, I think men have a tendency to turn everything into a competition, and I can't believe that's something that just started. I imagine cavemen back in the day were showing off their skills on killing animals.
Yes.
Better.
My deer is bigger than yours.
That's right. And so something that starts off as a kid's game obviously is going to evolve into, if it captures any interest, is going to evolve into a competition. Everything is a competition. So
absolutely. Absolutely. But keep in mind, back then it was still, for the most part, a friendly competition.
As is vintage baseball today. The reincarnation of vintage baseball today, for the most part, is a friendly competition.
And that's what I love about it. That's why I prefer vintage baseball to Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a chick thing. I don't know. But I don't consider myself to be highly competitive.
Well,
moderately so, but not like some people.
Being on
and that's what I love about vintage baseball. It's baseball for the love of the game.
And being on the East Coast, you're seeing the best vintage baseball. You're seeing some of the best players and clubs that there is to offer. And have you ever seen any vintage baseball played anywhere else in the country?
Well, Gettysburg. That's as far away as I've gone is Gettysburg.
So
I've been as far as Maine to Gettysburg.
Oh, okay.
And Gettysburg was great. I thought I'd die of the heat, but it was fantastic.
It's always out there. Is that not something you do every year? That's something you should be at every year.
I went once. I mean, it's a long drive. It's expensive. So I get to as many games as I can, and I think it was 3 years ago. I look back at my summer calendar. I think it was 3 years ago. I wasn't home any weekend. I was always on the go. And as much as I love it, I got a little tired of, 6 hours in the car to get somewhere. And then, maybe 2 nights and then 6 hours back. So as much as I loved it, I will go to a lot of local games around me, and I'll do that, and I love that. And, of course, there is the Doc Adams Vintage Baseball Festival at Old Bethpage in August, which, of course, we couldn't have this year. I felt so terrible for all the clubs. I felt terrible for the guys. I really did. But I go to that every year, and that's a blast. And it's in the most beautiful 19th century setting. It really is like stepping back in time. So it's a perfect spot for vintage baseball. So I would do that every year. But, I'm not getting any younger. And 6-7 hours in the car is... sorry.
No, it's not any fun.
Doesn't mean I'll never go again. I don't want to leave that impression. But I've tried to hit all the big ones once. Let's put it that way.
Hey, getting you know, we went off, and I'm going to bring you back to where we were.
So we know where we were.
Doc was on the rules committee from 58 to 61, and in 1864, the fly rule finally passed. He was involved, especially in the Knickerbockers, as an administrator, as an official, pretty much his whole time as a player. Am I right?
Absolutely. He was elected. He joined the club in late 1845, and the following May, he was elected vice president. And in 47, he was elected president and would serve about eight terms until he left the club as president. And he served as a director in other years. And in other years, he didn't hold any position at all, which I think was probably his choice. He was involved in other things. He was a practicing physician. And he was very involved with the New York Infirmary, which was for the treatment of the poor, which was a volunteer position. He lived right around the street from the New York Infirmary. He was also a vaccine physician for the city of New York. So he was involved in other things. But, yes, he served as president for about 6-7 years while he was in his 17 years with the club.
You know, this is going to sound like a stupid question, but from what I've heard from you, and this isn't even all the extra facts you can find out about him, he invented shortstop. He played baseball. He invented shortstop. He produced balls and bats, and he was not only a player but a significant official, vice president, president for the highly historic first official, air quotes, team, the New York Knickerbockers. How many of those things alone should have him in the Hall of Fame?
And yes.
You put them.
You'll get no argument from me.
I didn't think I would. But I guess the more I delved into this and looked into it, because the only thing I knew about Doc Adams was what I would hear from you, and I would watch some of your interviews. You can go on YouTube and see many interviews with Marjorie.
Oh, God, I saw one yesterday. Dear Lord. Anyway, go on. It's like watching the picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh.
I'm watching myself age on YouTube. It's not fun.
I understand what you're saying. I've never listened to an episode of my podcast because I can't stand the sound of my voice. So it's kind of the same thing.
Just like me, I've never listened to any of my podcasts, ever. And I never will. You can't pay me.
So out of those things you've said so far, what is the biggest one that just you scratch your head about that you can't understand does not get the respect that it should?
Shortstop and 90 feet.
And those are big things. Marjorie, the one thing I did learn in listening to some of your previous interviews is Doc Adams didn't come into your life until much later on. You didn't know about this.
That's a bit of an overstatement. Growing up, I knew who Doc Adams was. I mean, there was always conversation in our family of family history stories on both sides of the family. Lots of stories. My parents felt it was important that we knew all these things. But so I knew about Doc Adams playing baseball for the Knickerbockers, and I might have known he created the shortstop position. But all these other things about him, I didn't know any of it. And some of it was I hadn't really taken the time. We do have the essay that my grandfather wrote in 1939, and I never even knew of the essay's existence until I was going through some papers of my mother's about 15, 16 years ago. And I looked at it, and I went, oh, this is interesting. I'm glad we have this, and I put it back in the file. So much of what I have learned about all of this, I owe to several very fine historians. I list them all because if any of you come across their writings, they are not a waste of time. John Thorne, of course, who is the official historian for Major League Baseball. Bill Reisig, Richard Hershberger, Peter Morris, Thomas Gilbert, Eric Miklich, and Bob Folks. These men are amazing for what they have found out. They really are. I knew more of the personal stuff, of course, than they did. But all this baseball stuff, anything I know about it, I owe to those men. Oh, and Peverelli, Charles Peverelli. I don't know if your members know who he was. He wrote a book on sports in the late 1890s and included all the mid-19th century baseball clubs in New York City with all sorts of detail of meeting minutes and the games and where they played them and what the score was and where they all went for dinner afterwards, sort of thing. And it's in reprint. And I have that as well. So I owe all these people an awful lot. They taught me 500 times more about Doc than I ever knew when I was starting out.
And you can find out a lot of that kind of information right on that website, that docadamsbaseball.org.
Yes.
When you go to the front page here, it says in 2015 he was the top vote getter for the pre-integration era ballot.
Yes.
And he
that was the first time he was on a Hall of Fame ballot.
And he was two votes short. Have you ever talked to the voters that don't vote for him?
Wouldn't I like to? I'm short, but I'm mean.
I see that the vote this year got postponed until next year.
Yes.
Did you
not the best news I've received this year?
Did you have
but
a
then
feeling?
It is 2020.
Did you have a feeling this was going to be the year?
Yeah, I really did. Well, no, I don't want to say nothing is a sure thing.
Sure.
But I was really optimistic, or reasonably optimistic, that not only would we get him on the ballot, but that maybe this year he'd get voted in. Because the next time they're going to do this ballot is in 2030.
Oh.
And I probably won't be here for that.
You will.
I will probably be sitting on a cloud somewhere, hopefully. And hopefully I've gotten all my questions answered that Doc has answered all my questions.
Will you be, is there anything you can do in that 10 years to speed it up?
No, there's nothing we can do to speed it up. We do have an online petition on our website. It is absolutely safe, secure, and private. We do not farm the names. We do not sell them. So, of course, I would encourage people to sign the petition and to spread the word. Anything they want to do through their clubs to spread the word, I would appreciate that. And I just have to continue reaching out and educating people, either through podcasts such as this or through the various baseball pages that I'm on Facebook, who get new members all the time, or they keep seeing the name, who's Doc Adams, Doc Adams, Doc Adams. That, I have no other avenues. I can't go with a sandwich board up to the Hall of Fame and
you could
parade in front of the front steps, or I can't go over to Doubleday Field and rip down the sign.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Doubleday.
Who?
What's that?
Never heard of him.
Okay, then I guess we don't have to talk about Abner. Is it Abner or Ebner?
Abner. Abner.
He does not think he invented baseball.
No. There is nothing. There is nothing in Doubleday's writings, not a diary, not a letter, nothing that mentions baseball. Not a thing. Now, you would think if he had invented the darn game, he would have at least told his very good friend Al Spalding. But he never told Spalding either. There is, I have read, I haven't seen the letter, but I've been told there is a letter that Doubleday wrote in about 1880. He was head of a fort in Texas. And I've been told there is a letter he wrote his quartermaster in Washington. And he requested the implements of baseball for his men. And that's it. So
why does everybody think he invented it?
Oh, that's a long and twisted story. And it would take a long time to tell it. But part of it is when Al Spalding formed a commission with Abraham Mills to find out the roots or who did invent baseball. This was in about 1904. I don't know. I have to look up the date. Early 1900s. And I'm sure half the people listening to this know the date, even though I can't remember it. Spalding was good friends with Doubleday, but they were approached by a man named Abner Graves, a very old man who'd been a mining engineer, who said that he knew Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York, and had seen Doubleday invent baseball when they were children. Well, there are a couple of problems with that story. Number one, in the magical year of 1839, when Doubleday was supposed to have invented the game, he was a cadet at West Point for the entire year, and there is no evidence that he ever left West Point for that year. Plus, Abner Graves eventually, I think, ended up in the booby hatch. I think he went insane. Maybe even criminally insane. I forget all the details now. So Abner Graves' credibility was thin at best. Plus, Doubleday never said anything about it. Doubleday never made the claim that he invented baseball. And as I said, he was very good friends with Al Spalding. And he never mentioned it to Spalding. I mean, that's kind of odd. Plus, Abner Doubleday even described himself as being very bookish. So, no, there's no truth to it. And nor does the Hall of Fame even say that anymore. I mean, Doubleday doesn't have a plaque. But it was very convenient in 1939 to crown Doubleday and put the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. It was during the Depression. So it was going to give an economic boost to Cooperstown. It's just, at least it's in the right state. At the very least, the Hall of Fame should be in New York City. But obviously, they're not moving. Cooperstown's awfully pretty anyway. So we'll leave it there. I just wish they'd change the name of the field, that's all.
Sure.
That's so annoying.
Are you saying when they came up with the Baseball Hall of Fame that they needed to put a name on the father of baseball and that's who they chose?
Yes. And part of it was Doubleday was a hero of the Civil War. I mean, that much is true. So he was an American. He was a general. You know, he was a hero of the Civil War. So he had all the other boxes were ticked in terms of anointing someone the father of baseball. But I think, and John Thorne talks about this in his book, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, which if you all haven't read it, read it. I think he said something about Doubleday had been dead 10 years before he was anointed, before he knew he was the father of baseball. I think that's from John's book. That's a great book.
Yeah, Baseball in the Garden of Eden.
Let's go ahead and
throw that recommendation out there.
There are several others. And, you know, I have a recommended reading list. I really should post it on Scott's on the website. There's a new one that's just come out by Tom Gilbert called How Baseball Happened. It's just been published. I got it 2 weeks ago. And I've read the first two chapters. It's absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
What was the name of that one?
How Baseball Happened.
Oh, Baseball.
By Thomas W. Gilbert. And it's just been published. You can get it on Amazon.
And most people that listen to this will.
Well, in which case, I'm going to email Tom and ask for a percentage.
You should make your calls right after this.
No, it's a very interesting book because, and he takes sort of a different angle on it. He looks at the history of baseball through a socioeconomic cultural lens. More than first a club was formed and then they made this rule and then they made that rule and then they got uniforms and then they played this. It's more of what was going on socially, culturally, economically that made these teams form. And that's fascinating.
Did anybody in your family, including you, because I don't know the answer to this, write a book about Doc Adams? Is there a Doc Adams book out there?
No. And, you know, I've thought about it. But to be honest, A, I'm not enough of a writer. And B, we just don't know enough. I mean, if we had something that Doc had written about his years in baseball and what he felt about it and what he was thinking and so on and so forth, then we'd have more to draw on. I mean, one could write a long essay, but a book, no, there just isn't enough. I have them here actually, 150 letters written to Doc by his father from 1827 to about 1862-63. His father died in 64. And not one letter mentions baseball. No. Not a one. And there is a letter from 1833 in which Doc was at Yale at the time, or at Amherst at the time. He hadn't yet transferred to Yale. In which his sister writes him. She was 11. And the sentence from her letter is, "I have not played with your bat and ball as you bid me. I forget it every morning, and indeed I have not seen it since you went away." That's it. 150 letters, and that's the only reference to sports. Frankly, I think the father hid it from her, took it away. That's my guess.
It was Doubleday.
Yes, it was Doubleday took it. Yes, there you go. Abner came down from Cooperstown. I know, isn't that funny? And but these letters are very interesting because they don't talk about baseball. There's one letter from March of 1845, keeping in mind that Doc joined his club in the fall of 1845. So this was about 7 months before. There is a letter from his father talking about how glad I am that you haven't accepted this position in Springfield. You're much better off, in essence saying, you're much better off staying in New York and taking care of your patients there. So obviously Doc had been offered some sort of job in Springfield, Massachusetts, which he had already decided to turn down when he got this letter from his father. So imagine if Doc had left New York in mid-1845. He never would have joined the Knickerbockers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we'll never know. But it's kind of fun to speculate what might have happened or not happened with the game of baseball, where it might have ended up. if anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually an interview I did with somebody who takes the town ball game.
Oh, yes.
And they actually have put in, he's a mathematician, the gentleman that's in charge of it, and they put together what it would look like today if baseball never took off.
Oh, my heavens, that's fascinating.
And what would town ball look like today? So they did mathematical equations, and it's actually one of my most listened to episodes. But
is it still up on your Facebook page?
You can go to my archives on Podbean. You can find the podcast on podbean.com, and you'll see all my episodes there. I'm going to look up, I can't remember the gentleman's name off the top of my head, so I'm going to look it up we're talking. But
that sounds so interesting. What were his conclusions?
Well, there's a lot of running.
And a lot of plugging, probably.
90 feet is a dream.
Yeah.
For what?
Okay. And no foul territory.
No,
I don't think the Massachusetts game had foul territory. Plugging was allowed.
I don't think there was. I'm just bringing it up now, but it's a fascinating listen to, and he likes to go around the country as much as possible. You know, it's actually not, people don't care a lot, and that's what he's trying to do, is get people to care a little bit more and show, and they actually play it. This is out in Washington. They actually play it by those rules, and he was supposed to come here during the summer this year to Michigan, and we were going to have an exhibition match of that as well as a vintage game, because he's actually never played in a vintage match before.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, maybe next year he can come, and you'll have to video it.
His name is Daniel Jones.
At least he's got half the right name.
It's Roller Out the Barrel Extra number 4, so it's not an official episode, but it's between Daniel Ketch Kelly of the Mohicans and Jake Newcomb of from Maine. It's between those episodes.
Jake. So I know Jake, good guy.
So Margie,
nice club.
Let's and beautiful country, I would assume.
Oh, absolutely, it's beautiful up in Maine.
You must up in Maine, if you're playing baseball and you have that kind of atmosphere, you probably fall asleep once in a while just looking at the trees.
It was lovely. It was summertime. It was nice and green. And then they treated us all to a lobster dinner afterwards.
What? All right.
Which was fabulous.
Everybody that's listening to this needs to schedule an away game to Maine.
Yep.
They're serving lobster up in Maine.
Oh, boy. Nothing finer. They made it all there, and corn on the cob. And everybody, and there was a leftover lobster. And I said, well, I'm going to have a second one because it's for Doc. I'm eating for two. I'll never forget it. I had two lobsters. It was, oh, my God, that was good.
No one will blame you for having two lobsters.
Nope. I needed to go through a hose afterwards. I was just head to toe lobster. Darn, I want that now.
Tell me about the butter, Marjorie. Tell me about the butter.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, my Lord, my cholesterol level that night must have been as far as the moon.
Oh.
I don't want to think about it.
Hey, Marjorie, I want to take some time out and get to know more about you. People that are listening to this don't know anything about you except your fight for Doc Adams and for what's right with the Hall of Fame. You were born in New York City. Is that right?
That is right. My mother's side of the family goes back to New Amsterdam in New York City.
Let me ask you about this, something that happened in the news very recently. Rick Moranis got punched in New York City.
Oh, yesterday, I know.
What is that all about?
Well, I'm sorry to say, New York has pretty much gone to the dogs recently. And it's how the city is being run, and it's a terrible shame.
The guy quits acting to raise his family after his wife passes away and comes back and is in one commercial and gets punched. I mean, we'll never see him again.
I know, isn't that what an embarrassment? That's humiliating for the city. Gosh, I hope they catch the guy.
And the guy didn't seem like he was afraid of being caught as he walked
away.
Well,
they aren't, because they will catch them. They will charge them, and then they release them. They don't send them to jail until a trial. They just release them. And I've heard cops being interviewed in New York that the ink isn't even dry on their report, and the thug is already back out on the street. That's the new law, this catch and release program. It's just extraordinary.
Well, maybe not if you punch Rick Moranis.
I hope not.
He might not get back on the street when they find him.
Anyway, so it's very sad. Yes, it's very sad what's happened in my city.
You attended Stevens College. Is that an all-girls college?
Yes, it is. It's the oldest women's college west of the Mississippi.
Where was the closest all-boys college?
Right across the street, the University of Missouri. Well, I'm not stupid. You think I'd go all the way out to Missouri and not have a boys' college nearby? Hello?
Right across the street.
It was the 60s, Matthew.
So was it the same school and they just put two different names on it?
No, they were two different schools. Two different schools. Very funny.
So what did you go to college for?
To get away from the East Coast. That was actually part of my motive. Well, back then you had to get a 4-year college degree if you wanted to get a job. At least that's what we were always told. So I went out there and majored in broadcasting, because just for lack of anything else, I said, this will be fun, and it was. And it was the best 4 consecutive years of my life.
Oh.
Were my 4 years in college.
Do you have a college story that you're willing to tell?
No, it was the 60s. Actually, I do. It was 2 days before Thanksgiving, 1970. And as a Christmas present, my parents had given me a plane ticket to go out to San Francisco to spend Thanksgiving with a cousin of mine who lived out there. He was quite a bit older than I and had 6 daughters, all of whom were older than I was, and yet this man was only a first cousin. And so I flew out on there on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And I happened to get an earlier flight, and when I got to the airport, I called my cousin and I say, yeah, I know, I'm here. I know it's a long drive. Don't worry, I'll just sit in the waiting room and just look for me there when you get here. He said, okay, fine, because he was about an hour away. So I'm sitting there with my suitcase, and I'm reading a book on Edward R. Murrow, and these 2 cops passed me, looked at me, and kept walking, and then they came back again, and they started asking me who I was and where I was going, and did I have an ID? Well, this was 1970. This was Vietnam era. This was, well, if you're over a certain age, you know where I'm headed. And I said, well, I haven't done anything. I'm just sitting here reading. And they said, would you mind coming with us? And I said, where? They said, to the FBI office. We want to verify who you are. Huh. Well, what? I had a choice. So I went with these 2 6-foot cops up to the FBI office with my heavy suitcase, and they sat me down in a chair. They took my driver's license, and they called my name into some phone number. They said, do you have anything on the Marjorie Adams? I was so freaked out. And I said, why am I here? They say, well, you look like someone we've been told to look out for. And I said, who? They said, Bernadine Dorn. And I'm sure that name doesn't mean anything to anyone who is listening to this. Are you there, Matthew?
I am here.
Okay, sorry.
I was just...
The phone sounded dead for a minute.
I was
Bernadine Dorn, at the time, Bernadine Dorn was on the FBI 10 Most Wanted list for the bombings at the Democrat convention in Chicago in 1968. She's the common law wife of, I'll think it's his name. He was a terrorist. He still is an unrepentant terrorist. So I was up there in the FBI office for about 30 minutes. And they said, well, since you really are Marjorie Adams, you can go now. So I had to drag my suitcase because nobody offered to help me back down 3 flights and then back to the waiting room. Our suitcases weren't on wheels then. And since I packed for every eventuality from hail to volcanoes to tidal waves, I had everything I owned in that suitcase. And back I went, sat in the waiting area for my cousin to come and get me. I was shaking. I was so scared and I was so angry. And while I had been in the FBI office, I looked at her mugshot, Bernadine Dorn. God, I hope I didn't look like her. How depressing was that? And when my cousin came to get me, I told him this story. He thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in his life. And that night, he said, oh, we're going to call your mother. We're going to call your parents and tell them. So they get mother and daddy on the phone. And I didn't make the call. He did. And he said, hi, Adelaide. Guess what? Marjorie's in jail. And I could hear my mother screaming without the telephone. I didn't even, I could hear it right from out the window. Oh, poor mother. And calm down, Adelaide. Everything's fine. And poor mother is near tears. And I get on the phone and held her hand and told her everything was fine. And no, I wasn't in jail. So that's my favorite college story, that I was mistaken for Bernadine Dorn in 1970.
So Bernadine Dorn is married to Bill Ayers.
Bill Ayers, that's right.
And they're both leadership. They both have leadership roles in the Weather Underground.
Absolutely. And they tried to convict him for bombings in New York City of a police station that killed several policemen. But because of some prosecutorial technicality, they couldn't complete the trial. I think it was declared a mistrial. And Bill Ayers was also the one who did an interview with the New York Times, of course, that appeared on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, the day of the, that was a different time, that was somebody else. But in an interview, Bill Ayers once said, when he was asked about the bomb, if he was sorry that they didn't do more.
Oh.
And he is still a professor of the University of Chicago.
Whoa, that's tough.
That's harsh. That's pretty harsh. So anyway, we won't go there.
No, let's not go there. Let's no. Happy thoughts. Happy thoughts.
Yeah, but that's anyway. That's my favorite college story. Getting mistaken for a terrorist.
Yeah, you can go on. I just went on Wikipedia real quick, and Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers pop up for you nice and quick. So if you guys are listening, you want to get into that.
Here's the best part of the story. What your younger listeners won't know, there was no TSA then. There were no metal detectors at airports. You just showed your ticket and you got on the plane. There was none of this other nonsense. Well, not nonsense, but there wasn't in this crazy business. Well, the most important fashion accessory of 1970 that Bloomingdale's had was a belt made out of spent M16 cartridges. It was sort of the pseudo Che Guevara look. Well, I was wearing that belt under my coat.
Oh.
And I was so terrified they'd ask me to take off my coat. I'll never forget it. So at the FBI office, I said, Marjorie, I don't care how hot it gets. Keep your coat on. You'd never get through a metal detector today.
No.
Oh, my God, never. Oh, the crazy things we do in our youth. I wouldn't buy that stupid belt today for anything in the world.
That story is one of the best stories that's ever been on my podcast. I thank you for the you getting mistaken for a terrorist. great story. When you left,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So the only thing I was going to say, the only thing I had in common with that woman was the right of trial by jury.
Oh, yeah, it seems so. When you left Stevens College and you had a broadcasting degree, is that what you eventually did, is you got a four-year degree in broadcasting?
Yes. It was a BA degree with a major in broadcasting.
So when you
left, it was just your garden variety BA degree. It proved I could do it. It proved I could get through 4 years of college.
Well, that's something. What did you do when you grew up, Marjorie?
When I grew up, I'm still waiting to find out, Matthew. So, can I call you back?
No.
I know it's a little late, isn't it? It's like middle age. It's always 20 years older than you are now. Well, I went to work for a small radio station in Putnam County, New York, Westchester County, New York. I was the secretary and did the on-air lost pet notices and the local bulletin board, on-air bulletin board and things like that, and typed up traffic logs. And I worked 6 days a week to earn extra money, and I'd go in on Saturdays and type up all the traffic logs. And then I went to work for CBS in New York and in their radio research department, all number crunching, all green eye shade sort of stuff. Interesting, but, oh, and I just did other things in the broadcasting industry, all back office, none of it glamorous, but and I kept the food on the table, and I enjoyed it. And then I switched careers about 15 years, 20 years later, and I went to work for Ethan Allen, the furniture company.
Oh, yeah.
In one of their stores, and loved it, and was there until I retired back about 6-7 years ago. So, loved it.
Wow.
Yeah, spent more time with Ethan Allen than I did in broadcasting.
I guess so. But, hey, if you find something you love,
yep,
does it matter?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is the most overrated piece of furniture?
Overrated.
What is a piece of furniture that everybody, you buy a house, you need new furniture, and you're like, I need one of those, but you don't need it. What's overrated in furniture?
A fancy dining room table.
Yes, a fancy one. You need a dining room table.
You just need a dining room table.
Oh, so you guys, so were you like in sales on the floor?
Yep, I was.
So you were working on commission.
Yep.
And when
25 years.
And when you told everybody about your FBI getting mistaken for a terrorist story, they were buying furniture left and right. And
absolutely.
With your personality, Marjorie, I assume that you did quite well on the commission side of things. Am I right?
Yes, I did.
Yes, you did.
Yes, I did.
And that's why you did it for 25 years.
She says modestly.
That's all right.
But that doesn't mean it wasn't hard work.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And anyone who's worked on commission knows that.
Commission.
Commission.
Marjorie, we have come to the time of the show. If you have listened all the way through some episodes, I do this segment once in a while called Giving You the Old Pepper. And I'm going to ask you 10 random questions. And they're questions about you and your likes and dislikes and stuff. And
oh, dear. All right.
It's easy. This is easy stuff. And we're just going to get to know you a little bit better.
Oh, dear.
Starting with this question.
Do you think anybody's still awake?
Absolutely.
Okay.
This is going to be my best episode. What is your favorite pie?
Apple. Hot. With a big hunk of sharp cheddar cheese on the side.
Cheddar cheese?
That's how we eat it in New England.
Oh, I'm writing this down.
Oh, that's good stuff. The pie has to be warm. Has to be sharp cheddar cheese at room temperature.
Oh, my. I'm going to try that today.
You haven't lived.
Apparently, I have not. What is the last movie you saw in a movie theater?
I don't remember. I saw a movie last year. I never go to the movies. I saw one last year. In fact, I was on the phone with a friend who I'd seen it with. We were on the phone a week ago, and I said, what movie did we see last year? She couldn't remember either.
Oh, geez.
So I'm sorry. I do not remember. If somebody named some movies from last year, I might recognize it. Obviously, it made a great impression for me. I don't think I fell asleep in it. But obviously, it made a great impression. So the last one I remember, I don't know. I'm sorry. I go so seldom.
No, that's
next question
next
that
question.
I can ask.
Do you prefer a bath or a shower?
Oh, God. Shower. Next.
Next question. When you're in the shower, what song is it you're singing?
Put Me In, Coach.
Oh, that's a good one. You're not singing that in the shower.
I don't know. I don't sing in the shower. I mean, what did you want me to say, Matthew?
I didn't want...
Jingle bells? I mean, jingle bells?
I mean, if it's Christmas time, you might have singing a jingle bells here or
no.
there.
No. When pigs fly, Matthew.
What is one of your biggest fears?
Fears. Death.
Okay. Fair enough. Do you believe in aliens?
No one's proved to me that it's not possible. So until somebody proves it's not, I'm keeping an open mind. Besides, I worked retail. I've met them.
What is your favorite beverage?
Coffee. Strong coffee, light with milk.
I know I'm going to love the answer to this question because of what we talked about with apple pie. But if you were going to have a last meal, what would it be?
Lobster, baked potato, corn on the cob, all fresh. None of this frozen crap. And then I don't know if you have the brand out in the Midwest, but there's a commercial brand of baked goods called Entenmann's. Here in the East Coast.
Yes, familiar.
Entenmann's makes a chocolate cake with chocolate frosting. And I just, before I die, I just want to go face down in an Entenmann's chocolate cake with chocolate frosting. Just once. To do something really decadent. I mean, just really stupid, wasteful and decadent. That's what I would do.
All right, Marjorie.
Sorry. I had to ask.
That is an awesome answer. And and we're going to stop it there because that I
oh,
can't.
Oh, thank God. This is embarrassing.
I can't top that. Marjorie going face first into a chocolate cake.
By Entenmann's.
We can actually make this happen. Enough people you know.
Are you making bets now? Is that it?
Enough people you know are going to listen to this. I'm just saying. Yeah. If you see one of these Entenmann's cakes.
Just when I thought it was safe to go to the mailbox.
Well, thank you so much for
doing
this, Marjorie.
Thank you, Matthew.
This has been great.
Thank you. It was fun for me, too. I appreciate it.
What a pleasure.
And please, I hope everybody will go to our website and sign the petition for Doc. I surely would appreciate it.
Once again, that's DocAdamsBaseball.org. You can find Marjorie on the Facebooks and tell her how awesome she is. Oh, my God, aww. Marjorie, you are a delight.
You.
I have to tell you that.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Matthew. And this was a lot of fun for me. Sure beats root canal.
Well, thanks.
See, I knew it would be fun. I've listened to your other podcast. I knew this would be a fun morning.
Wait a minute. I'm interviewing somebody who's listened to my podcast?
Yes, I have.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, they're well done.
Wow.
You're to be congratulated.
Thank you.
I don't know what your day job is, but you've got a future as an interviewer.
I deliver beer.
Oh, my God.
I
bet they love you're the most popular guy in town.
Most of them, yeah. You know, most of them do like me. Well, but there's always outliers in life.
Yeah, always. There's a curmudgeon. There's one in every crowd.
There's nothing you can do about that.
Well, I thank you, Matthew, so much for this opportunity to talk about Doc. I really do appreciate it.
And thank you for teaching us as you want to do, and letting us learn a little about you. You are fantastic, and
thank you.
Take care of yourself, and
thank you, Matthew. You too, and have a great day.
You too. Stay in line for me.
Yep.
And everybody out there listening, thanks for listening. You were just treated to, I don't know, my Stairway to Heaven of episodes. So I'll probably quit after this. No, I won't. But thank you. Thank you for listening. More episodes to come out soon. Ashton Semper Fi.
Post game show is brought to you by... Christ, I can't find it. The hell with it.